What is going on, everybody? John Middlecoff, 3 and Out Podcast. It's about 4 in the morning. Had to wait for this game to end. Not really, but it's about 9:30. I don't know how you guys on the East Coast do it. Obviously, college football is a little bit longer than NFL. Monday Night Football usually starts at 5, is over by about 8:05-ish. College football started at 5, and I don't know, that's a long game. But that was fun. We'll talk about Burrow, Eddie O, and Lawrence off the top. Then we're going to dive into just about everything. Mahomes, the 49ers, Mike Vrabel, an old famous coach he kind of reminds me of, the Packers, Seattle, the Browns, Drew Brees to TV maybe, Lamar Jackson, Kirk Cousins, and then obviously the Middlecoff mailbag, at John Middlecoff is my Instagram handle. Slide up in those DMs, and it's the easiest way to get a hold of me. And I actually already recorded it earlier today, answered a bunch of questions. Smart, because I knew the national championship game was going to be long. So I recorded a lot before, so I'm not going to have to do too much. But let's start with the national championship game. You know when you're growing up, like when I grew up, my dad always told the story like how he went to lunch with Mickey Mantle. And the part of the story was like Mickey threw down like 5 or 6 drinks before appetizers got out. But part of it was like, you don't understand. Like he was just always in awe of like Mickey was such a big alcoholic. But like him going to, you know, my dad was older, passed away a couple years ago, but he was in his 70s, like got to watch Mickey Mantle play. And was like, you don't understand how good Mickey Mantle was at baseball. And there are players, like my dad, a big 49er guy, used to swear about Joe Montana being better than Steve Young. And obviously, he probably was. But I could never really have the argument because I didn't really see Joe Montana play. And especially the majority of your, like when you're young and you're arguing like, no, Steve Young's better or Brett Favre's better. You're just going off what you have. And again, for the kids, like there's going to be a group of kids, you could make an argument and you just go to YouTube and do your own little scouting. I couldn't do that. You just kind of went with what you saw. I know this. I will argue for the rest of my life that what I watched Joe Burrow do this year was just beyond stupid. It was freaking incredible. Like it just had a loss for words. I had multiple NFL scouts text me tonight like, that's the best college season I've ever seen a guy play at quarterback. His athleticism, his deep ball accuracy, his playmaking, he dominated. He simply dominated. I'm pulling up his box score right now. 463, 5 touchdowns, but he had an incredible season. He had a season that will live on as a legend. And tonight, officially, Ed Ogeron and Joe Burrow and all those guys, but those guys are the headliners. We'll never pay for anything in Louisiana again. I mean, those guys are made men in the program. I would imagine they'll get a statue. Because this wasn't just a national championship season. It was we're the best freaking team in the country by a wide margin. That offense that the LSU had, they have the number one quarterback, this guy's going to go number one in the draft, who had the greatest statistical season in the history of the sport. I think he wiped out Timmy Chang, the kid from Hawaii. Remember, they used to run like the Mike Leach spread offense, June Jones. This guy's running an NFL offense, just 5, 6, 7 touchdowns a game. Now, you know, he is playing with an NFL running back. That kid, number 22, is probably going to start in the league. Maybe not as a rookie, but eventually. Someone DM'd me. They're like, bro, have you seen, like, do you think that DeAndre Hopkins compares to the Chase guy, number one for LSU? And I'm like, you know, it's pretty bold praise. I haven't watched that much of him, but DeAndre Hopkins elite. And then about halfway through this game tonight, I'm like, yeah, that kid's going really high. And then I realized he's a sophomore. Jordan Jefferson, number 2, is first-round pick. So they got special, special players. But Burrow, the cream always rises, and he was their best player. He was remarkable. I thought Honey Badger, Tyrann Mathieu, put it perfectly. He was at this game tonight, and his tweet was pretty simple. Joe Burrow is better in person. And I was thinking, Honey Badger, you perfect tweet. Because when you see something in person, you go, wow. It's one thing to watch something on TV, especially a sporting event. But when you go watch Tom Brady in the peak of his powers, or Mike Trout in the peak of his powers, or LeBron James, or Steph Curry, they blow you away. You know, and I can't imagine being there tonight, what was on the line, given where the game is, how special that performance was. And very, very cool moment for Ed Orgeron. A lot of people like myself, you know, referred to him as dumb, referred to him as, I can't believe, SC never should have hired him. And you know what? SC fans love talking about it. He didn't belong to you. Ed Orgeron belongs in the South. Now, would he have been better than Clay Helton? Of course he would have. But would he have done what they did? Probably not. Like, he was perfectly suited for the South. And I say it all the time. I've been fired a couple times, and it's led me to be much happier. And it's led good things to happen in my life, because it forces you to kind of reevaluate. It forces you to change. It forces you to be uncomfortable. And Ed Orgeron, when he didn't get the job at USC, I remember he was devastated. And I think he might have gone to the Saints for a year before he then... Maybe that was before, but he definitely, then he got on to LSU staff with Les Miles. His life changed. And now I turn the TV off. I'm sure he'll be in tears. Like, this is a moment that a guy, I can't even imagine. Like, I'm from the West Coast, and college football is nowhere near as big as out here. It's not big out there. Or down there. It's a way of life. It's part of their culture. It's part of, you know, God, family, football. And all three, there's not like one, two, three. They're all basically even. Like when you meet guys from the SEC, it's God, family, football. You know, it's football, family, God. I mean, the order may change a little bit, but they're all the same. And you could see the magnitude of this moment for the guy, how much Joe Burrow will always mean to him. And, you know, Joe Burrow gave the speech of the Heisman Trophy, how much that guy, like Joe Burrow said, he gave me the keys to this program. And it's not like this is Texas Tech. I mean, this is LS freaking you. And it changed everyone's life. And those two guys will be immortalized in that state as long as they live. And well after they're gone. You know, it was that. Everyone that witnessed it, everyone that saw it live will never forget it. Because I never will. I would say the best teams I'd ever seen before this were the Ohio State team and some of the Miami teams in the early 2000s. The Reggie Bush team. But this team might have been the most complete, given their firepower on offense and how good Joe Burrow was. Like, he's better than Matt Leiner. You know, he's better than the quarterbacks at Ohio State or Ken Dorsey. He's way better. He's in a completely different level. So that to me is the trump card. Because when you think about it, a lot of, like, I'm 35, a lot of the teams that I vividly remember watching, like the late 90s and the early 2000s, like, their quarterbacks weren't NFL guys. Even like the sweet Nebraska team under Tom Osborne, it was like Tommy Frazier. So just special, special night. The SEC flexes their muscles again, and Ed Orgeron and Joe Burrow, I'll never forget it. And most sports fans worth their salt won't either. And on the flip side, Trevor Lawrence wasn't very good tonight. Just period, point blank. He definitely has all the talent. He's everything you look for in terms of size, arm strength, in theory accuracy, but he was terrible. He was awful. Now, could some of that to be to blame is LSU, probably every DB they have is a first-round pick. Their wide receiver struggled to get open, but he was airmailing guys left and right. He was erratic. He didn't play winning football. It's just that simple. He did not play winning football. And once they kind of could corral Etienne, who's going to be a really good NFL player, they needed Trevor Lawrence to play like Joe Burrow. And he didn't just not play like Joe Burrow, he just didn't play good. I mean, he threw for 230 yards and didn't have any touchdowns. If Joe Burrow is going to throw for 450 yards and 5 touchdowns, you're going to need Trevor Lawrence at minimum to throw for 3 or 4. So it's just a lot of people tweeting at me, a lot of people DMing me. Is this going to hurt his draft stock? Is he overrated? I don't know if he's overrated because he has all the requisite talent. And we've seen a guy like Jameis Winston, you know, be very, very inaccurate and still go number one overall. So I think this guy's on the path to be the number one overall pick. But I do think you can nitpick him a little bit. Like, you'd have to go back, study that film, go, why was he overthrowing guys left and right? And really, if you think about the Ohio State game, they took off when he ran. Here's the thing. You know what, NFL people? I don't give a shit how you run. Like, it's cool. And you get Twitter thinks you're great all season long. You know what happens in the playoffs? You got to throw and make accurate passes. We just saw it with our guy Lamar. Like, running's fun and all. It's sweet. You can have all these yards all season. Run for 11, 1,500, 1,200, whatever yards. Run for 10 touchdowns. It's cool. When the rubber meets the road in January, in college football and definitely in the pros, and it's 3rd and 8, you got to hit the guy in the hands on a deep out route from the opposite hash. And Trevor Lawrence wasn't even close. I mean, Shaquille O'Neal or Kevin Garnett in their prime couldn't have caught the ball. I don't know what was up with the guy. I like him. I mean, who doesn't? You can see the skills, but he was borderline atrocious tonight. Now, I do think you got to chalk it up. LSU, their defense is awesome. The other standout player, that Isaiah Simmons, number 11 for Clemson, he, to me, and I tweeted this tonight, I think he's the second non-quarterback off the board. And when he goes to the combine, a lot of coaches are going to be, what position do you play? And he's going to look at him, he's going to list like 7 positions. Well, I can play outside linebacker. I can play basically a stand-up defensive end and pass rush. I can play strong outside linebacker. I can play middle linebacker. I can play safety. Hell, you need me to, you know, cover a tight end in the slot? I got you, dog. I mean, there's nothing he can't do. Special, special player. An elite player. I don't see, now, depending on how the quarterback works, but I think he's got top 5 written all over him. If I had to go my top 5 Middlecoff draft board right now, I would go Joe Burrow. I'm going to put 2 at number 2, assuming the hip checks out. I would go Chase Young. And again, I'm putting Tua over Chase Young just in the fact that I like quarterbacks are more important. I'll go Chase Young. I'll go Isaiah Simmons. And I will go Herbert, based more on upside and just talent. That would be the top 5. And there's a ton of other good players in this. I mean, this draft's pretty good in the first round. But that, if that's your top 5, Tua, Burrow, Isaiah Simmons, and Chase Young, that's pretty star-studded right there. Again, I'm assuming Tua's hip's going to check out. But Simmons, then you see Clemson. I mean, they had an off night and their quarterback was bad. They got elite talent. They got elite talent. And Dabo's now, he's been to 5 national championships or 4 national championships. He's won 2 of them. So it's a shitty night for him. But it's also a symbolic, like, we're pretty freaking good. I mean, we get here all the time. And that there's something to be said about getting there. You don't need to win it every year. Part of the Patriots dynasty and even the Alabama's dynasty is they were going to the playoffs every year. Alabama never missed the playoffs till this season. So if you go to the playoffs every year, you're in pretty good shape. And that was a fun game. Little long. You know, we'd like to keep those clocks running clock if it's a little bit of a blowout in the second half. That'd be the Middlecoff rules. But a fun night and just happy for Eddie Ogeron. That was pretty cool. Okay, let's dive into what we saw in Kansas City a couple days ago. And it was simply remarkable. You know, you only see stuff like that every so often. It actually was a first in NFL history. A team up 24-0 in the first half is then losing by halftime. First time it's ever happened in the Super Bowl era. I think the highest number before that was 21-0. It had never been as high as 24-0. So what we saw was remarkable. But I think sometimes, and I am guilty of this, we go, we have never seen this before. Lamar Jackson. Yes, we have. His name is Michael Vick. Even Mahomes. Like, we've never seen Patrick Mahomes before. I think we kind of have. His name is Brett Favre. And he felt Favre-ian on Sunday in the comeback. Just his energy, his remarkable physical gifts. But the one thing I think Mahomes has, and this is a cross-sport comp, and I felt it for many years going to games, even before Kevin Durant showed up, there was something with Steph Curry when the Warriors could be down. And people forget, there were many games over the years, definitely once Kevin Durant came, where they just didn't give a shit. And they would just kind of coast to start a game. And all of a sudden, they'd be down 20, 25 points. And you never, ever felt like they were going to lose. Because the moment Steph Curry would hit a couple threes, he'd start shimmying, he'd start shaking, the entire crowd would awaken. And it would be on like Donkey Kong. And there was an energy that came off of him. Just, I understand if you don't like the Warriors, you thought he was hot-dogging. And he is. Well, Mahomes does too. But that type stuff, when you're at home or to your teammates, you don't care what the other team thinks or what some fan on Twitter thinks. It's about giving them the belief. Because deep down, you know, they say the most successful people in the world are eternal optimists. Well, you have to have some of that as a player, especially as a quarterback, the point guard, you know, the head coach, whoever you are, because you can't just, you know, when it's 24-0 or you're down, you know, 30 at half or whatever, just look at the squad like, yeah, we're screwed. It's over. Let's just, who cares? You know, there is, especially in the NFL in a playoff game, and texting around, like probably most people, like, are they really going to go out like this? I never stop totally believing. Now, 24-0 is a huge number, but they have Kelce, they have Tyreek Hill, they have Sammy Watkins, they got the rookie Hardman, they got dudes that can just fly. And then they have the special catalyst, and that is Mahomes. Now, it's hard. Marty Mordingwig told me once, and I think Andy Reid would know this as well, he thought the best player he'd ever seen in all of his years in the NFL was peak Favre, like 95 to 97, when he won three straight MVPs. And Mahomes clearly didn't win the MVP this year, but like, who's the better quarterback, Lamar Jackson or Mahomes? Give me a break. There's zero people in the NFL, including John Harbaugh, that wouldn't take Mahomes over Lamar Jackson. That's not a conversation. That's not even hate on Lamar Jackson. He's become a fantastic player, and he should only improve. Mahomes is a different level. Mahomes is an all-time great already. The dude's a legend. Think about this. The Kansas City Chiefs, for 50 years, had never hosted an AFC Championship game. Now, in back-to-back seasons, they're hosting AFC Championship games in 50-plus years of the conference championship game. Started in 1970. They'd never hosted it. Now they're back in back-to-back years, and that was a game yesterday where you're like, I don't know, it's just not their day. It's a little cold. They're off. They're rusty. And it didn't matter. They scored 51 straight points. And Andy Reid took Romeo Crennel out behind the cleaners and absolutely just ravaged him. And the reality is, when you got a guy like Mahomes, just like when you have Steph Curry, and that avalanche starts, the crowd feels it, the team feels it, and there is no looking back. There is no stopping it. And there are only a few players in sports, probably basketball or quarterbacks in football. I think Russell Wilson definitely has this characteristic. And it's a little harder for him, even though, God, he's fantastic, because his team's just not as good. Where Mahomes, his team is so much better, his offensive line's better, clearly his skill guys are better, and his offensive play caller is on a completely different level than Seattle, but there's no stopping it. And once that avalanche cop starts coming down the hill, bodies are getting buried. There is only, you can run, and you can hope to avoid it, but if it catches you, you're getting wiped out. And Bill O'Brien, who, you know, Coach Reed supported him after the game on the fake punt, I'm just going to vehemently disagree. Because the momentum in the game, I do believe game to game, there's no such thing as momentum, right? Because a new game starts. They say in baseball, the next day's pitcher is the momentum, and it's true. Like in basketball, baseball, whatever. There is no such thing. Now, there's an internal belief when you go into a game, like I think the Titans have, but if the Titans just play crappy, they'll lose. Like, you need to play well in every game. Now, I do think your confidence raises. That's what makes Mahomes special. Like, he doesn't need a great season to be super locked in. He doesn't need a great season to then make him confident. I think the dude's just kind of born with the swag. You know, he just kind of has. We hear this so often, and the reality is a small percentage in sports, just like in life, have the quote-unquote it. And he clearly has it. And when you factor in the offense he plays in, the players he plays in. But when you're playing the Chiefs, and they are laying a complete egg, and you're, you know, I don't even know what yard line they were at. It felt like the 30. But you're up 24-7, and you run a fake punt. The crowd is completely silent. The Chiefs are borderline dead. Now, there's a lot of game left. I think there was 8 minutes to go. But when you ran that fake punt, and then it gets stuffed, you woke up the crowd. And worst of all, you woke up Mahomes. And then they scored, and then obviously they fumbled on the next kickoff return, led to another touchdown, and the rout was on. There was, by the time he fumbled on the kickoff return, after they had scored the touchdown on the stop fake punt, the man on the moon knew this game. Now, I didn't know they were going to score 51 points, but the Chiefs were going to win the game. And Bill O'Brien deserves criticism for that. Like, in that situation, it's reckless. And I am the number one proponent about having balls. About having big old cojones. in business, in football, whatever you do. I think what truly separates people in this country, we're capitalism, is the way that we operate, is having stones. The smartest people are not the richest people. It's the most aggressive people. And clearly football is an aggressive game. So I'm all for going for it in situations, running fake punts. But in a situation where you're up 24-7 on the road and you're on your side of the field, so it's not like, it'd be one thing, right, if you were at midfield and maybe you think you can totally cut their head off, but you gave them the ball, which the Chiefs' red zone basically starts at the 40. So it was reckless. Like there is a fine line, and it's a slippery slope, and there's a lot of gray area between having stones and being reckless. And I got to take the L on Bill O'Brien. I've often supported him, and I don't think he's some village idiot. His team goes to the playoffs all the time, but he is not anywhere near the top tier guys. The Andy Reids, even the Sean Paytons, obviously Kyle Shanahan's, even Pete Carroll. Like he's in another category. Now he's not Tom Sula or Freddie Kitchens or anything, because he clearly is a capable guy. But I'm sure you saw the video on TMZ where he's screaming at the fan. Like he's got a screw loose, and I'm pro guys that have screw looses. Like most people that are successful in football, definitely, and you could argue in business, are a little nutty. Normal people probably aren't the most successful people financially in their field. You got to be kind of nuts. And Bill O'Brien might be too far on the nuts side, because that one, what I don't get, there's no rhyme or reason to what he does. Like with John Harbaugh, he was consistent all season long. He was going for it. Bill O'Brien, remember that game, I think it was like week 17 against Tampa, he refused to go for it. And then this game, he's running a fake punt. And then he claims when they kicked a field goal, I think the next series, or maybe it was the series before, they didn't have the right play call. Like, Bill, what are you talking about? But when you're unsure like that, and when you're kind of lost upstream without a paddle, and you're facing the Mahomes, who is the Steph Curry of the NFL, and that avalanche starts coming, it's going to bury you, it's going to kill you, and you're going to lose the game. Okay, let's dive into the 49ers. And I was at the game on Saturday. I learned something this weekend, and really all season. I've been to like three games this year. The Seattle game, a Monday night game against the Browns, and then that playoff game. And for about 5 years, the 49er stadium, now granted, I live, you know, I'm parallel to San Francisco. I live in the suburbs. I like my space. And, you know, it's like 45 minutes away. With traffic, it can be a little longer. But on Saturday, it took me probably 40 minutes to get there. So, yeah, I mean, Candlestick was actually just as far, too, because you had to go over the bridge and kind of through the city. But I get it. It's not in the city, so it got kind of dumped on. And rightfully so. Santa Clara. Now, granted, here's the irony of the whole thing. Bill Walsh, their offices have been down there for 35 years. So they basically just built the stadium where their office was. We, the fans, were just accustomed to having Candlestick close to the city, even though Candlestick, for those of you that have never been there, was in the hood. And it was not a safe environment at all. People often act, and players and everyone act like the Oakland Coliseum was like the ghetto, and you had to be worried about getting, you know, taken out at a game. I'll promise you, having been to both places, Candlestick was way worse. So they didn't build there. The city, it's San Francisco's such a messed up place. There's not much room either. Couldn't have built there. Maybe you could have. I don't know. Ended up in Santa Clara. It got dumped on. But the reason they got dumped on, because the team sucked. The team was god awful. And this year, the team's sweet and people are there. Here's the way it works. On the West Coast, when you're really good, we can support a winner as well as anybody. San Francisco Giants, San Francisco 49ers, two of the biggest brands going. The LA Lakers, same thing. The difference is we ignore a loser. I lived in Philadelphia. When we lost my second and third year, I would imagine the radio ratings went up. Same thing in New York. Same thing in Boston. They thrive in losing. They like it. They also like winning, but they don't mind losing. It's good for the media business. People have opinions. Here, we ignore it. We don't care. Apathy sets in really quickly. Not me. I mean, this is what I do for a living. This is what I care about. It's what I talk about. But the casual fan, like I am dependent on my business when I do Bay Area stuff on them winning. Because if they lose, people just tune out. It's really a simple formula around here. So the 49ers, that place was rocking. And having watched this 49ers team all season long, the one thing social media loves telling you, it's like the softening of America, how the soft people and nice people are winning now. And again, when I say nice people, I believe that like you can be an aggressive human being and be a tough-minded human and treat people well. I'm not saying treat people shitty, but like give ribbons for seventh place, and that's something as society's changed. And everywhere that tells you like that's what's in vogue now. That is what is in vogue, just like in football. It's a passing league, and it is a passing league. But like you can get away with Lamar Jackson running around. No, you know what works in life, just like in football? Toughness. Now, in football, it's actual physical toughness because you're actually hitting someone. In life, it's mental toughness. In football, it actually incorporates both. But that is never going to change. Ever. Ever. In this country. What works? Tough people dominate in every freaking industry, including the NFL. And when you looked at the two games on Saturday, the San Francisco 49ers and the Tennessee Titans, they came in and they hit their opponent square in the jaw. And that opponent quivered to the ground. And then they just kept swinging. And I'll give Seattle credit. They operate like this too. They had no business this year winning 11 games, being in the second round of the playoffs. But they are like a Chuck Liddell in the MMA. All they want to do is just throw blows at your face. And that works in football. Because why? Because football is a violent game. It's a tough game. Now the rules have changed. And during the regular season, passing, you're an idiot if you don't. Cornerbacks can't press your wide receivers. Your wide receivers don't have to be worried about going over the middle because they can't hit you. And if they do, a flag comes out. Your quarterback can't get hit. The rules and the officiating leans to a quote-unquote softer game. But just like the NBA, when the playoffs start, people swallow their whistles a little bit more. It gets a little more violent. Just like, yeah, you can give that seventh place ribbon to little Jimmy. But guess what? When he's 28 years old, and he needs his first big meeting with his firm or whatever the hell he's doing, he's either going to have to put up or shut up. No one gives a shit how he feels. That's just a reality. And the faster you learn that, the better you off for life. Right? Life's not fair. And I would say the more mentally tough people usually thrive. In football, the more physically tough teams usually thrive. And the 49ers, at every level on defense, their defensive line when Dee Ford is in the fold and healthy, which hasn't happened much, is dominant. Nick Bosa, I was wrong. He isn't just good, he's elite. I've been talking about football, watching football for a living now for 10 plus years. If you factor in college, about 13. He's by far the best rookie I've ever seen. And again, I was on record, I would have taken Quinnen Williams. That's insane, because I couldn't have been any more wrong. This guy's better than his brother. He is an elite player. A complete ass kicker. I had a front row seat for Khalil Mack's rookie year. This guy is in a different category. Now, Khalil became a special player, but he was raw early on. Now, granted, he was coming from Buffalo. Nick came in like a seven-year vet. Not like a seven-year vet that's been to the Pro Bowl six times. Kicking ass, taking names, and destroying everything in his path. It is really, really impressive. And then the two guys they got from Oregon are 6'7". They look like an NBA player that are 290 pounds. They're unstoppable. Then you look at their linebackers. Fred Warner is a tackling machine. They got Quan Alexander back, just kind of the heart and soul of the team. They have multiple other linebackers. They've drafted Dre Greenlaw, the guy that had the tackle in the Seattle game, that's built for this modern game because of his athleticism. But all three of them lay the wood. And the one thing I tell all my NFL buddies, like the thing that separates this Niner unit is their DBs. A lot of times, I think Herm Edwards uses this term a lot, contact courage. Football, back to the violence of the game, like you got a guy running full speed, and we all watch the combine, we know the speed in which most of these ball carriers, running backs, tight ends, are moving, coming right at you. Some people don't have contact courage. And a lot of corners, and I always defend them on this, if you're a cover corner, what Primetime once famously say? They don't pay me to tackle. He's right. They pay him to cover. But every guy on this Niner team, obviously Richard Sherman's one of the best tackling, the guy, to me, he's the best tackling corner of all time. Kwaski Tart lays the wood. Jimmy Ward lays the wood. Emmanuel Mosley, their backup corner, who's now their starting corner, lays the wood. And Quan Williams, their nickel corner, physical player. all of their DBs hit like linebackers. Now, they're not as big as linebackers, but the violence in which they attack a ball carrier is that level. They're hitting everyone, and they're hitting them hard. And a guy like Kirk Cousins, who, let's call a spade, somewhat of a mental midget. When times get tough, he is not physically capable of overcoming. He does not have the talent. It's just that simple. Like Rodgers, whether the Niners rattle him or not and they're hitting him, like he's good enough. He can overcome it. Now, I don't know. I'm going to pick the Niners in this game. But when Rodgers is on, the throws he can make, he's an all-time great player. And he's proven, like, you might beat him, but it's not because he doesn't have the physical characteristics to make plays happen or you can hit him. Like, Kirk Cousins wilts. As I think DeForest Buckner told Albert Breer in the MMQB article that he wrote the other day, we knew we could get him seeing ghosts. That's who you were dealing with. Take away the money and the $85 million contract. He's not talented enough. And then a team like the Niners are just going to hit you over and over and over again. They're just going to keep swinging on you until you say uncle. It's really that simple. And then their offensive style is, for most young coaches, typically they're going to throw the ball. Why? Because throwing gets you jobs. It's fun. We all love it. Throwing bombs. Kyle Shanahan dreams about running inside and outside zone. And in that game, I think there was a point in time in the second half where he had 8 straight runs on a touchdown drive. And then the next drive, he had 2 more straight runs. Jim Harbaugh once, I think against the Arizona Cardinals in like 2012 or 13, ran the play power. It's when you put a fullback and a running back in the I formation and you run it basically behind, let's say, the right guard and you pull the left guard to lead up. So you got the fullback and the guard leading the hole. It is the ultimate tough guy play. And I think in a game, in like the peak of the Harbaugh years, he ran power. I don't know if it was the same side. It might have been, I think, 8 or 9 straight times. It was basically, we're tougher than you and you can't do shit about it. And the thing is, and I was talking to a buddy in the NFL, it's not like the Vikings are soft. I mean, they got Anthony Barr, Eric Kendricks, Harrison Smith, Everson Griffin, Danielle Hunter. Like, they got dudes. And they got shoved around. Because the Niners, where they really separate themselves, is toughness. And when you think about the 49ers historically, you think offense. Bill Walsh, West Coast offense, Kaepernick, now Kyle Shanahan. The irony is, and I'm 35 years old, and I started watching the Niners that I can remember in the early 90s, their defenses were awesome. In 94, which I still think is one of the best teams I've ever seen, they were littered with defensive all-pros and Pro Bowlers. From Bryant Young to Dana Stubblefield to Deion Sanders to Tim McDonald, they had Ken Norton Jr., Gary Plummer. They've always been Merton Hanks. They will knock you out. Obviously, the Harbaugh years, for as much as we talk about Kaepernick and the pistol, it was Bowman, Willis, Justin Smith, Alden Smith, Ahmad Brooks, scumbag Ray McDonald, but he was a dominant player. They and Whitner and Golston, they were just cracking skulls. And this defense is a little different than the Harbaugh defense. It's more built on speed. It's just perfect for 2020. Teams a little more spready. You need a little more speed. The Harbaugh teams were built more for, you know, stop the Marshawns and the power runs and the physical teams. But at the end of the day, in the playoffs, now in San Francisco, you know, it's 57 degrees. Now, granted, for us, that's cold. It wasn't Lambeau. It's not Kansas City. But the toughness and physicality plays in cold weather. It plays in January. It plays for Super Bowl teams. Just like, you know, the guy that was told, you need to get better. They got a 7th place ribbon when he was 7 years old. That's not good enough. I mean, that's Tiger Woods, probably. You think Earl Woods gave him a standing ovation when he finished 5th when he was 8 years old or 7 years old? Of course not. Now, granted, Tiger probably wasn't finishing 5th many times. But being mentally tough, being physically tough, that will always play. Okay, let's dive into... Start with Mike Vrabel, and then we'll dive into the Packers. It hit me this weekend, watching Vrabel, who, you know, just the ultimate guy's guy. What a badass. If he was the coach of my favorite team or in the city that I lived, that'd be awesome. He's a cool mofo. It's hard to not see Mike Vrabel and go, yeah, that guy's sweet. That guy just kicks some ass in his day. Looks the part, played the part. Now has a team that had no business being this far in the AFC Championship game. Incredible story. But I was thinking about this when I was watching. I'm like, who is he? And I was got up early this morning on Monday and had CNBC on in the morning. There's not much, like, I can't really do sports TV or sports talk radio in the morning till like Coward comes on at about 9. Like to get my mind working a little bit and just have something on, you know, auxiliary noise in the background. Just have CNBC in the back. And they were talking how Elon Musk, like, there's never going to be another Steve Jobs, right? But he was a pretty unique personality. I bought the enormous Jobs book. You know, I'm going to be honest. I made it through probably 40% of it. It's huge. He's nuts. I mean, the guy was certifiably insane. Again, when I talk about usually nut jobs are the guys kicking ass. But in a good way and in some ways bad. I mean, could be an asshole to people. But there's not going to be another Steve Jobs. But there is kind of somewhat of this unique personality now in Silicon Valley named Elon Musk. Who also, if you've read and just Google, like, Elon Musk slept in his office, started all these businesses. Some of them failed. Some of them worked. Obviously, now is Tesla. Just a special, unique, kind of outlier human being. And he's kind of like Jobs, a showman. You know, he's the closest thing probably to Jobs. Now, is Tesla going to be Apple? I don't know. I mean, right now their stock's over $500. But he's just, when you say Elon Musk, kind of like Steve Jobs, he evokes emotion. You're going to have an opinion on him. You know, I get a lot, like my brother's in the farming business, and I bring up, you know, Jeff, you want to get the Tesla truck? He thought it looks terrible. And then he goes, Elon doesn't make any money. Everything's subsidized. And he's never really made any money at Tesla. You know, it's one of those classic kind of tech firms that, like, eventually they got to turn a profit. But Mike Vrabel, it kind of hit me. Do you know who Mike Vrabel is? Now, there are differences to this human being, but Bill Parcells. Bill Parcells was a big guy. He was a massive personality, and he gave zero Fs about anything. He was not scared, zero hesitation going into any game, because the way that he coached, the intensity, the physicality of his teams, defensive-oriented guy, and he was just a badass, like the Big Tuna. Like, I'm not talking Dallas Cowboys, mid-2000s Big Tuna. I'm talking Giants in the mid-80s with Parcells by his side, that Big Tuna. The guy who was constantly screaming at players, screaming at opponents. It was like, this guy is sweet. The one guy who could go toe-to-toe with Walsh and gave Walsh fits, him and Belichick. And I think when you look at Vrabel, you go, this guy has a little Parcells to him. Now, the 2020 version, you know, he's probably not as big of an asshole. And I think some people would tell you, like Peter King that covered him, like, Bill Parcells is actually a nice guy. Now, I think he could be, like, kind of a dick if you were working for him and just the intensity of being around him all the time. But that's a football coach. They get stressed out. But, like, when I see any clip that goes viral of Mike Vrabel screaming at opponents, one reason, like, if I saw, like, Freddie Kitchens screaming at an opponent, like, telling him F you, calling him whatever, I'd be like, Freddie, you're the biggest clown of all time. When Vrabel's doing it, I go, yeah, Mike Vrabel thinks he would beat that guy up right now without zero hesitation. And he'd probably be right. And there is some Parcellsian kind of parallels to Mike Vrabel that I see of just this leader of he has a team that isn't quite as talented of the team he's taken on. Now, underrated part about the Tennessee Titans, they have talent. I mean, they have a good offensive line. They have a star running back. They have a star rookie wide receiver. They have excellent defensive linemen. Rashawn Evans, the linebacker from Alabama, number 54, has really become a player. I never say the guy's name right. Number 31, the safety. The guy that Deion Sanders didn't know who he was, who's like an all-pro. He's a stud. Their corners have improved a lot. Like, they have a talented team. But Vrabel has these guys believing like they could take on the 85 Bears or the 84 49ers or, you know, the 93 Cowboys. And they shouldn't. And to me, that's a Parcells-like characteristic and quality because you look at him, just his intensity, one, just his size. Now, he's unique because he played, and he played for a long period of time for Belichick. And I see this a lot on Twitter. Like, can we just stop acting like Vrabel coached for Bill Belichick? No, he didn't coach for Bill Belichick. But he was the guy's team captain for several years. And he was one of the key players on a stretch where they won 3 Super Bowls in one of the years where they went undefeated and lost in the Super Bowl. Like, this guy had a vital, vital role. So when Bill Belichick was instilling these complex game plans that he's known for, right, of taking your number one, whatever makes your offense tick, he's going to take away. Well, that's how Mike Vrabel thinks, because he was a part of the installation of those game plans as the team leader with Teddy Bruschi and Rodney Harrison to install that with his team. And then he was on the field to execute it. And clearly he's a cerebral type guy, despite being 6'4", 260, whatever he is. And then he immediately got into coaching when he was done playing, worked for Urban Meyer, worked for Bill O'Brien, a Belichick guy, and now is running his own team and just kicking ass and taking names. Now, I think if you Google Parcells, it took him a little longer, you know, to kind of get his shot. Maybe he became a head coach, you know, maybe in his mid-40s. Now, I think Vrabel is also in his mid-40s, but clearly a big portion of that in his 20s and 30s, he wasn't coaching, he was playing. But he was probably doing a lot of coaching-like stuff when he was a player because of the way he studied. He wasn't the best athlete. He wasn't, you know, the most talented guy, even though I think he was, you know, a mid-round pick, and then he bounced around on practice squads. But he's just, he's got it, and it's pretty clear. And if you've watched football long enough, which everyone listening to this probably has, you know, this guy's pretty special. And I do think, like, he's not Belichick. He's really much closer to Parcells. And when you look at the Packers, one thing, like, I kind of fall with Colin on this. I don't think they're that good. But you're 14-3. You're in the NFC Championship game. You've had a hell of a season. You still have Aaron Rodgers, the first ballot Hall of Famer. You still have Devontae Adams, who's one of the, I don't know, seven or eight best wide receivers in the league. Where their franchise really changed. And I think if you're McCarthy, now I get you're with Jerry right now, and you're walking around the Star in Dallas, and you're checking your bank account, and the new direct deposits are coming in, and you're feeling good. But you got to go, you know what? Ted Thompson really screwed me over the years. Now, we don't have unlimited budgets like Jerry Jones or Jeffrey Lurie or Stan Kroenke, but in the NFL, everyone has money. Even the broke guys like Mike Brown and Mark Davis get a big check from the league. So we can afford to pay for players. But Ted Thompson fundamentally disagreed with signing guys outside the organization. Really, in the last 28, 29 years, they've done it three times. Reggie White, Charles Woodson, and really Charles Woodson didn't cost as much. And this year's Za'Darius Smith, who also, when you look at his number, only got $20 million guaranteed. Za'Darius Smith changed their franchise. Because whenever I watch him and they're winning, and clearly they do a lot of winning, they've won 14 games, he is unblockable. They put him inside, they put him outside, against the run, obviously against the pass. He has been a force. You can't list five better defensive front players this season than him. Hell, you might not be able to list three better ones. Maybe Derek Watt had a better season. Not Derek Watt, TJ Watt. Well, Khalil Mack didn't. You know, think we're find me the best Shaquille Barrett maybe with Tampa. But he wasn't really playing. Now, I know they battled back, but they were 3-7 at one point in time. Za'Darius Smith, the Packers had a great record and were kind of setting the tone, you know, all season long. So I think that the Packers, I give them credit that Gutekunst clearly just didn't follow the Ted Thompson blueprint, because it worked. I mean, for a long period of time, operating like Ted Thompson, drafting, developing around Favre and Rodgers led to a ton of wins. Division championships, playoff victories, but usually expose them in the playoffs because we go, God, they're a little soft. Well, when you got Za'Darius and Preston, they are not soft at all. Their DBs all hit. Really, their weakness is probably linebacker. But signing players, like, you got to sign players. You need to supplement. You're not going to bat 1,000 in the draft. Even if you're doing good and drafting 50%, you're going to have a ton of holes. Look at the Patriots. Historically, they've signed guys. Chris Hogan, Burkhead, Stephon Gilmore, signed Jamie Collins back, Patrick Chung back. Now, granted, they drafted some of those guys, but Gilmore's a good example. And definitely on offense, they've signed a ton of guys over the years. Look at this 49er team. They traded and paid Dee Ford. They went and signed Richard Sherman. Like, those guys are pretty important in what they do. They signed Kyle Juszczyk, made him the highest paid fullback of all time. Been worth every penny. Every stinking penny. So if you're going to make a run, look at the Kansas City Chiefs. Boom, Honey Badger. Changed their defense. Also offensively. Now they overpaid this guy a little bit, but he is pretty important and makes them really potent in Sammy Watkins. Once upon a time, they signed Mitchell Schwartz as a free agent. Like, you don't need to be the Yankees. sign like 6 or 7 guys every year, because that's not going to work. But you do need to isolate 3 or 4 guys every offseason and be aggressive to get them. And usually you'll probably, if you're a good team, end up with 1 or 2 of the 3 or 4 of them. And if you got good scouts and you've isolated and have a good coach and have the right scheme for those players, it's going to work. Because a guy, if he's showing you what he is on tape and you're going to ask him to do that same thing for you, it will work. Where you get in trouble in free agency is when you see a guy doing something and then you ask him to do something else. It'd be like, you're the number one sales guy in Tempe, Arizona. And I own an IT firm. And I double your salary. And then I ask you to code. You'd be like, well, this is not going to work. That's essentially when free agency screws up. If you are a power running back, and then I ask you to be a third down pass catching back. And you're like, why is this not working? Because that's not what he did when you signed him. And I've seen it firsthand. When I was in Philly, when we signed Nnamdi Asamoah, asked him to play inside, and he couldn't do it. It turns out he was just over the hill anyway. But you have to ask guys to do what they're good at doing. And that's what the Packers have done. And to me, it starts with the general manager and the organizational shift on signing and isolating 2 or 3 guys that are impact players and being aggressive to pay them. Because, yeah, you don't have an owner like Jerry Jones that has unlimited cash in his bank. But you do have the NFL check. And that NFL check grows every year. And it's an enormous number. And the Packers took advantage of it this year and find themselves in the NFC Championship game. Okay, let's dive into a couple other just headline stories and, you know, other parts of the other games that happened. Let's start with the Browns. They hired Kevin Stefanski. And the big talk, and of course it was after the game, is after Minnesota-San Francisco game, there's no way the Browns, because it was clear, when I fell asleep on Saturday night, I think there was a report on Friday Robert Saleh was out. By the time Saturday came, and definitely by the night, it felt like it was basically his job. And then in the morning on Sunday, it's reported that Kevin Stefanski is the new Browns coach. And Twitter freaks. How did they watch the game? Did Paul DePodesta, the baseball guy, watch the game? My answer is no. Do you know what number and analytical guys believe, especially from the baseball community? That small sample sizes are meaningless. Billy Beane doesn't even watch baseball games. He works out. If you told me that Paul DePodesta went for a hike during the Niner-Viking game, I would believe you. He was going to put zero stock. The Niners could have won that game 100-0. And Stefanski and the Vikings and the Kirk Cousins and Dalvin Cook could have ended that game with minus 100 yards. It could have been the worst performance in playoff or regular season history. And Paul DePodesta wouldn't have cared at all. These baseball people, they don't believe in small sample sizes. They believe in what the masses think. Paul DePodesta loves that everyone thinks he's an idiot for hiring this guy. He thinks you guys are the morons. They're very black and white. It's quantitative. It pumps out of the Excel spreadsheet, and they believe it. And I say it all the time. My issue, everyone uses analytics. I was doing some accounting today. Talking 40 times. The combine's not too far away. Analytics are a huge part of anyone's life who lives in normal society. My issue with the analytical sports movement in football is, why can't anyone ever admit they're wrong? I admit I'm wrong all the time. I wanted the Niners to draft Quinnen Williams. Nick Bosa isn't just good. He's the best rookie I've ever seen since I've been professionally doing this for about 12 years. He's incredible. I say I'm wrong all the time. I thought the Vikings would put up more of a fight. It's like the number guys never believe they're wrong. Because when the number tells them they're right, they're right. And again, it's parts of their brain. Like, my brain thrives in gray areas. A lot of people that I know, they think like that. But I also know number people, that's just not the way they think. I've worked with them, with the Eagles. You get in an argument, it never ends. Because they're never going to back off. Well, I have no problem changing my opinion. If you present me with new information, I do it all the time. Invest in a company, it starts going backwards. Sold all my Netflix stock about 6 months ago. I just didn't like where it was heading. Now it's actually going back up. But you're crazy if you're not open-minded to anything. But to think that Paul DePodesta put much stock in this game, you're crazy, because that's not the way the Billy Beane process and all his minions think. He put zero stock in that game. Now, let me repeat, zero stock in that game. My big issue with the Browns is Paul DePodesta lives in San Diego. It's one of the most beautiful places I've ever been. I haven't been everywhere, but I've been a lot of beautiful places. Hawaii, New Zealand, Spain, Italy, Philly. I'm kidding. But he lives in San Diego. There's not a human alive that would rather live in San Diego than Cleveland. But when your football team is in Cleveland, you got to live in Cleveland if you're going to be the boss. And from the latest reports I've seen, he doesn't plan on moving to Cleveland. Yet, on Friday, part of the reports of this Kevin Stefanski deal, and I get why Stefanski or Robert Saleh, because I kept tweeting, like, these guys should turn down this job. But they probably both make about $1 million. If Jimmy Haslam, if you're making $1 million a year, and someone offers you $5 million a year for 5 years, so you could make $5 million over the next 5 years, or you could make $25 million. It's just basic math. If you're making $100,000 and someone offers you $500,000 for a guaranteed contract of 5 years, it's a huge, huge economic difference. But to think that you have to present your information to the analytic group on Friday, and that was one of the reports, to me is asinine. Because one, that structure isn't going to work. Because you should be working hand in hand with them throughout the week. There shouldn't be some like come to Jesus moment at the end of the week. And there especially shouldn't be that situation when these coaches work crazy hours. They get there at the crack of dawn. They don't leave till midnight, Monday, basically through Thursday. It is a grind. And to have this guy that's living by the beach, I'm sure, living like a king, where they all wish they would be, especially in November and December when it starts getting cold and snowy, flying out every Friday, hell, maybe even teleconferencing in from his place in San Diego, and then dictating what you're going to do in the game plan? We're dealing with humans here, not robots. If that is the setup, it is going to be the biggest tire fire in American history. Not just in sports, but in American history. That is destined to be, like Freddie Kitchens just blew up because Freddie Kitchens was a moron. This is going to be the infighting here. Like, we think the Browns have had a lot of infighting over the last decade. It's about to really amp up if this is going to be the case. Because, again, just whatever you do as a job. Imagine working, and this was, you know, when I remember growing up, I was never the smartest guy in the group, so I'd always align myself with smarter kids in group projects. They would do the majority of the work, and then I would just write John Middlecoff on the project, and then you get an A. But imagine if those people, you don't know those people, and they don't want you in their group, and you get in their group, and you try to piggyback the credit, and you come in on Friday, they'd be like, what have you been doing all week? It's just, it's basic human dynamics. It is not going to work. Now, I look at the thing, Jimmy Haslam, I don't know any owners in the NFL, so I don't know if it's normal practice to have a weekly meeting. I understand if you're the owner of the team, you want to know what goes right and what goes wrong. But I do think that you could just, because one of the reports is Stefanski has to meet with Jimmy Haslam every Monday. Which, I think if there's an issue, like something happened in the game, couldn't you just go into his office? You do own the team and just ask him what happened? Do you have to schedule a weekly meeting? Part of Monday is, one, to evaluate what happened in the game, and then two, look forward. I just think that they have too many chefs in the kitchen right now. And the best organizations, one, are all working hand in hand. Not separate, and then you get together at the end of the week, and you start fighting over what's going to work and what's not going to work. The other thing, you see the play sheet that a Kyle Shanahan that or an Andy Reid or whoever, any coach has. I guess McVay's got a smaller one, but most coaches have pretty big play sheets. Well, if you read that play sheet, like Andy Reid's or Kyle Shanahan's, it would, if you speak English, it'd be like reading Chinese. You would have no clue what any of this shit means. So how is Paul DePodesta or one of his minions, unless they learn the offense, going to know, well, like, X, Z, wing, right, razor, whatever. You know, the crazy play calls. I can't even do it. You know, tiger left, razor, slot, all that stuff. How do they even know what that means? So it's like you got to turn in the game plan / play sheet. Okay. I mean, I could hand you a book in Chinese. If you can't read it, what you could just look at it all day long and say it's right or wrong. I think the setup is already a disaster. And I'm not anti-analytics. I'm just anti your analytic guy who's in charge living in San Diego when the operation's in Cleveland. Like, that's a joke. And if you can't see that, then I just, maybe we don't live in the same planet. Because that's a clear setup that's not going to work. One story that came out that was kind of interesting is that TV networks have been sniffing around Drew Brees. To gauge his interest. My recommend to Drew, as long as someone's willing to pay you $20 to $30 million a year and you can lead a playoff team, TV ain't going anywhere. Now, the setup, but one day it might be on Amazon in 5 years or Netflix or, you know, Hulu or wherever the hell it's headed. But, Drew, you're going to be fine. Play as long as you can. You've been blessed by the grace of God to be able to play at a high level up until your 40s. And I think I read that he still plans on playing, but, like, it's cool. They're going to call you when you're 45, whenever you retire. So, unlike, you know, you saw Jason Witten, who ended up going back. Now, part of it, he was bad. Like, Drew Brees would be good. I think Drew Brees would be really good. I don't think he'd be as Romo-y. I think he'd be more kind of like a little more serious, kind of like a John Lynch. Like, John Lynch was really good at TV. You know, you don't need to be, like, Romo's kind of unique personality. But I think Drew Brees would be destined if he wants to. The difference of, like, Drew Brees is going to have hundreds of millions of dollars in the bank. Now, he loves football, but he also has little kids. Who knows? But if he wants to do it, I think he should. There's another big story by, I'm not trying to not give credit, I just forget, front office network or something, that ESPN, of course, Booger's not coming back, thank God. Nice guy, just, you know, ESPN, do better. And they're trying to. They're going to offer Tony Romo between $10 and $14 million to do Monday Night Football. To me, he's worth every penny. If John Madden was worth $8 in 92, I mean, it's just basic math, the top guy in 2020 should be worth $15. So if you're Tony Romo, to me, you have leverage. You just go, I will stay at CBS. CBS offers a couple things. One, they have the AFC. And now, granted, their quarterbacks are getting a little older. I'd argue the NFC, you got Mahomes, you got Watson, you got Lamar. Actually, it's pretty good. But you work with Jim Nance, like you work with a pretty powerful brand. They also have access to golf, which Tony Romo values a lot. But money talks, shit walks. And if they're going to offer $14 million, CBS is kind of historically cheap. Doubt they match. So Tony Romo, more than likely going to break the bank. It'll be interesting to see who he hires as his play-by-play guy. I mean, when you start paying a guy that much, he's going to dictate who he's going to want to be next to him. Lamar Jackson had a fantastic season. And you know the thing I appreciate most about Lamar in his worst moment of the year, because he was not good, and I thought Colin did a good job on Monday breaking it down. Just watch the game. You can give me the box score at the end of the game. The hollow yards in the second half were on full display. When the game was in the balance in the first half, he was atrocious. Turning the ball over, he could have thrown multiple picks. And yeah, his wide receivers dropped some balls. It's freezing cold. It's hard to catch the ball in inclement weather. When they can't run the ball, he can't function. And here's the other thing. Like, no quarterback is ever going to win the Super Bowl running around. Consistently running around. Quarterbacks that win the Super Bowl, Google it, throw the football. And he can throw the football, but he just has to become more consistent at it. He had a fantastic season. He earned the MVP. But he's not the best quarterback in the league. Mahomes is better. Russell Wilson's better. We'll just use those guys for... I was going to say Brady, but Brady didn't play that well. But those two guys are like... no one in the NFL, not one human being, would take Lamar Jackson over Mahomes if they could choose right now. Just like if I had to pick for the next 5 years, I'd take Russell Wilson over Lamar Jackson. Remember when they shamed Bill Polian for picking Russell Wilson, first team All-Pro? Like, did you watch the two guys this weekend? Do they play the same sport as a thrower? Sir, just ask yourself that. And I'm not anti-Lamar Jackson because I really respect the way he conducted himself in his post-game press conference. He's really mature. He's the opposite of kind of what Baker's become. He's an impressive guy. He's easy to root for. He's young. He just needs to keep adapting, and he'll be okay. Seattle, I've never seen a team quite like it. Not much talent, but just heart, toughness, and obviously the quarterback is... he's one of the most special players I've ever seen. He really is. And I don't know when it's all said and done what his numbers will look like. But for example, like Drew Brees. Drew Brees is like a fringe, borderline top 10 quarterback of all time. You know, somewhere between like 8 to 12. When it's all said and done, would you rather have Russell Wilson for 10 years in his prime or Drew Brees for 10 years in his prime? Because I'd take Russell Wilson. And, I mean, they both have a Super Bowl. Russell's obviously been to two. Drew can't make it past like the first round of the playoffs. But Russell is just, he's a freak, man. He's everything you want in pro sports. He forces the consumer to watch. He makes you feel good about when you pay a lot of money to attend a game. It's just, He's a special player. He really is, and I just enjoy watching him. Kirk Cousins, man. He just is what he is. He's a robot. He is very, very limited. And for the amount of money he got paid, he can never live up to it. Because the reality with him, he just doesn't possess the talent. Like Russell Wilson, Aaron Rodgers, Mahomes, even Watson, those guys, Lamar, those guys are so much more talented. Well, when you get to the playoffs, everyone's talented, right? There's no more shitty teams. You don't see the Bengals anymore. You don't see a discombobulated Browns. You just see good teams. Well, you're going to see good the highest level of coaches. Smart players, because good teams don't have dumb players. They have smart players. And he doesn't have the ability. As someone in the league told me, he is a preparation all-star. Really smart, which I respect. Works his ass off, can come into a game. But it's like if you prepare your ass off for a big meeting or some big, you know, investment strategy, and then you go meet the client, it's usually not going to go as planned. Sometimes you got to ad-lib. Sometimes you got to hang a left when you thought you were going to hang a right. And he's just incapable of doing that. And when your knock is, we got to make him throw. We got to make him be a drop-back passer. That's a pretty big red flag when you signed an $85 million contract that was fully guaranteed. Say that out loud. If you're the Minnesota Vikings and you sign him to that contract, and the number one game plan around the league when they play Kirk Cousins, let's force him to throw. If you're a good team. I mean, if you have bad corners, they have enough talent, they can get you. But if you got Richard Sherman covering Thielen, you got problems. And there was a play in that game where Richard Sherman picked the ball off that Cousins just can't see. Richard knows the route he's running, Kirk. He's standing right there. Can you not see him? Are you just so robotic? They're running the right coverage. This is what I'm going to do. Richard's smarter than you. And unlike you, Richard can't adjust on the fly. And he's sitting right where Thielen is supposed to end his route. And Kirk Cousins hits him in stride. That, to me, sums up Cousins, so far as Minnesota career, in big games. Okay, let's do a little Middlecoff mailbag, bang out a couple questions, and get y'all out of here. Hi, John. Love the show. Question. Who do you think is going to be the next quarterback of the LA Chargers? Well, I think I was reading today in an MMQB article that, you know, the Chargers might franchise him, but it's not a lock. That'd be Phillip Rivers. I don't know. I mean, call me. I always lean like, of course, you're not going to let the quarterback go. But at 38 years old, the season he had, I'm a Rivers guy, but he looked kind of washed that it kind of felt like it's just over. Now, teams hate just letting a guy go for nothing, but what are you going to do? Can you franchise and trade him? Maybe they're nervous if they don't franchise him and let him walk, he goes to like the Raiders. Who would the Chargers get at quarterback? I mean, they do draft high. They could draft Herbert. They could always sign like a bridge, like Dalton or something. But then you're asking yourself, why don't we just franchise Rivers? But do you want to pay Rivers like almost $30 million at this point? I don't really see it. So I would lean like a Dalton type guy and draft Herbert. Huge fan of the show and fan of the Colts. Going into next season, does the front office realize that Jacoby should not be our quarterback? Any chance we trade up for Tua, maybe sign Cam, Rivers, or Brady? Yeah, I think they would be I think they'd be all over Phillip Rivers. I think they'll be all over Brady. I think you could argue Andy Dalton's a better player than Jacoby. At least he was, like, when he was playing earlier in his career. I don't know if you trade up and draft someone, just given that so many teams need quarterbacks, so many teams are already up there. I don't know if that's really an option. So I would say that Jacoby, maybe they bring in a little competition. You know, I keep using Andy Dalton, Mariota, maybe try to resurrect his career, maybe trade for like a Nick Foles, do something like that. You know, your options are pretty limited. People keep asking about these quarterbacks. Let's just list them right now, just off the top of my head. We got Brady, who is a free agent. We got Rivers, who's a free agent, who looks like they might not tag him, or 50-50. Breeze, free agent, but he'll never leave. Foles, the flip got fired, so they could have a new offensive coordinator, could be on the move. Dalton, he'll be on the move, because Burrow will be there. Cam, potentially, I don't know, I have no clue what Matt Rhule thinks of Cam. If I had to guess right now, Matt Rhule probably just goes 1 year with Cam, just sees how it goes. Remember Chip Kelly, when he got to Philly, he kept Michael Vick. So not that obviously Cam's career in Carolina is better than Vic's in Philly. It was just kind of the 1 year. But you get what I'm saying. Like, you just need a quarterback. And I'm trying to think. Mariota. It's not as many guys as you think. You know, there's not seven Joe Montanas out there. So you just kind of is what it is. I mean, Jacoby is just a good backup. That's just kind of what he is. But you're kind of stuck with him. Everybody talked about Jason Garrett's contract expiring on January 14th. If the Cowboys had made the NFC title game or the Super Bowl, would his contract have automatically extended until their season ended? Or would the Cowboys and Garrett have had to sign an amendment to manually extend his contract? Yeah, I think you see a lot of guys in a lot of assistants. You know, their contracts end that kind of date, you know, first or second week of the season. And if you make it to the Super Bowl, it just rolls over. Not like another year, but you just get paid. Like, if you're making $1 million, must be nice. Whatever that direct deposit is, I think you just get it, like, for the other week. That's a pretty good question. I'd have to ask someone in the league that deals with that. But, yeah, I don't think you have to, like, you don't need to re-sign anything. You just kind of work on no contract at that rate, which, luckily, if you're an NFL coach, I mean, what was Jason Garrett making? Like, $7 million. So, he probably could have made it 2 weeks even if they didn't pay him. He would have been okay. Here's my question. I'm a Rutgers fan. What do you think of Greg Schiano? I've never really been a fan, but I do think he's perfectly suited for Rutgers. My first year at Fresno State in 2008, I was a GA, we played Rutgers. And he had the McCourty brothers. He had, I think Ray Rice was already in the league. He had a couple other NFL guys. Kenny Britt maybe on that team. And he's just perfectly suited for that. He really is. I was against when Tennessee and the fans revolted. I always thought they were right. He didn't belong in the South. He belongs in the Northeast. That's just kind of his. In college football, unless you're an elite coach, which he's not, like an Urban Meyer or even Nick Saban, you know, Chris Peterson, you can coach anywhere. But most guys, the majority of guys, need to coach in, like, Dabo, Eddie O, the South. Jimbo, the South. Jim Harbaugh would not do well in the South. Jim Harbaugh is a West, Northeast guy, right? Urban Meyer's an outlier. You can put Urban at Florida. You can put him at USC. You can put Ohio State. Put him at Washington. He's going to kick everyone's ass. For as much shit as I talk about Urban Meyer, I think he's a great coach, and he transcends wherever he goes. Nick probably even more than Urban, probably does just belong in the South. And you look at the job, I know he was at Michigan State, and he's such a good coach, he would work anywhere too, but he's really suited for the South. Like, Urban probably is perfectly suited for Ohio State or even USC, because I do think regions matter when in college. In the pros, it doesn't. Like, Matt Rhule, he could have coached the Panthers, he could have coached the Chargers, he could have coached the Seattle Seahawks, it wouldn't matter. Like Pete Carroll, look where he's really done damage. USC and Seattle. Like, the West Coast culture kind of fits him. My question is, Alex Smith coming back, and if he does, should the Redskins start him over Haskins? Well, if Alex Smith is healthy, which is a big if, I mean, his leg basically almost fell off. And that video, I don't know if you saw it, but it went viral like a month ago of his wife. It was like pretty touching. I mean, it was hard not to like get teary-eyed. That, like, him rehabbing of that leg, but it looks like he's, like, trying. I mean, I don't know. He'll have to get cleared to play. If he can get cleared to play and he's 100%, yeah. I mean, he's a better player than Haskins. Now, he missed this entire year. He missed the majority of last year, so he's missed a lot of time. Why do you think Pete Carroll has never won Coach of the Year or John Schneider, GM of the Year, with both of their recent success? Can't even talk. Love the show. I don't know. It's a good question. I mean, Pete, I'd have to look back on the years when he made runs to the Super Bowl. Like, who won it that year? Belichick? Probably not. I don't know. You know, it's just, I think Coach of the Year is a pretty hollow award. I don't even really think, who cares? You know, Pete Carroll's kicking everyone's ass every year. He's going to the playoffs every year. He's won a Super Bowl. So, yeah, I wouldn't put much into that. I'm a big fan of the podcast all the way in Brazil. That's cool. I really enjoy listening to you around, you and Colin. I was doing a little research, and I'd like to ask you a question. It's pretty clear that the Broncos will cut Flacco this offseason. At least they should, right? Yes. What were they thinking? I really don't know. Me either. If they do, he will be responsible for dead cap money on back-to-back years in different teams. A total of almost $30 million. That's got to be some kind of record. Is there any way to finding that out? Keep in mind, it's the same contract. Denver just made some cap adjustments. That's a hell of a question. Yeah, I could probably text some people. I don't know if you can like run queries on that. I'm sure NFL people can. Odell Beckham cost, I guess, you know, he's going to be on the Browns this year, so it won't really matter. But he cost the Giants last year like $20 million on dead cap. So the, every year, guys cost money on dead cap. I think Dez Bryant and Tony Romo this year cost money for the Cowboys' dead cap. I'm like 99% positive that Tony Romo and Dez Bryant. Because moving signing bonus money back is just kicking the can down the road. It's like a credit card. Eventually, that credit card payment is due, whether it's due now, whether it's due in 6 months, whether it's due in 5 years. You have to pay the money, you know, and Jerry Jones was king of that. He pushed all their money back. And Flacco a little bit like that because he signed those enormous contracts. And it was that's why the Ravens were always letting sweet free agents walk because they had so much money on Flacco. You were right. Stuck to your guns. I took the Titans. Love it. It's Lamar versus the Chargers part two, but you can claim zero credit. Sports, right? Yeah, I mean, it's just Lamar struggled in the playoffs. No, there's just no way around it. He just the playoffs has thrown him off. I was wondering if you would like to do an interview on a podcast I co-host called The 2-Point Conversion. This is a political-free podcast where we just talk about football. Please let me know. My phone number is... I'm not going to read your phone number out loud. Okay, I'll shoot you a DM. Maybe I could get on that podcast. I do other random podcasts here and there. Lamar Jackson played well all year, but most of the time he had an early lead. Against the Titans, they were behind and struggled to mount a comeback. It's apparent that quickly became frustrated and then self-imploded and he met adversity during the game. Do you think his immaturity played a role in his poor performance? I think when you... I'm going to say when you use the word immaturity, you're using it as a player because he's actually a really mature guy. Just the way he handles himself. I mean, he like relative to Baker, it's not even close. I just think it's difficult for them the way their offense built. I tweeted this during the game. The Bills and the Ravens have inaccurate quarterbacks. I mean, Lamar can be accurate, but in rhythm, like he's hit or miss. Josh is much more inaccurate. And they surround him by a bunch of midget wide receivers. Now, the Ravens, in fairness, have a couple tight ends. They got Andrews. They got the redhead Hayden Hurst. So they got some big bodies. But like Marquise Brown, Hollywood Brown, who's awesome, can fly, he's tiny. Like, you know what you need? Like, I'm watching the national championship game. You need to get Lamar and Josh Allen some of these dudes. Higgins, Jefferson, Chase. Get them some dudes with huge catching radiuses. It's hard. It's one thing when you're Peyton Manning or Drew Brees and you can close your eyes and hit a guy in the hands. It's another thing when you're not that accurate and thrown to a bunch of little tiny guys. Like, you need some size for these guys. Huge fan of the pod. Can't believe the Texans versus Chiefs game right now. What is your MyBookie promo code? Ham and the number one. That was a crazy game. Okay. Mailbag. Good day from a show in Australia. As a Texans fan watching this implosion today, would love to get your thoughts on whether Bill O'Brien stays as the head coach. In my opinion, we definitely need a GM and potentially an OC in the offseason. Easy to say, but who would you hire? Well, Bill O'Brien said today that they're not going to hire a general manager, and he's going to keep calling the plays. So I feel for you, man. I don't know. He just struggles. He needs some help. He needs people in his life to tell him, like, no, this is not a good idea, or no, don't do this. And he clearly doesn't have any of those. Odds Andy retires after this year if he finally gets a ring. Had an argument with someone the other day about this topic. Would love to hear your thoughts. I think there would be zero, and I repeat, absolutely zero chance. I'd say the number one reason he wouldn't retire is he loves football. Absolutely loves football. Like, it's, beside his wife and kids, it's his life. Two words, Patrick Mahomes. Three, he makes a lot of money. I mean, we're a lot of money. So when you factor in, you love what you do, you get paid a boatload of cash, you got a sweet job. I mean, he's got, the Chiefs is a great job. Clark, I don't even think Clark Hunt lives in Kansas City. He lives in Dallas. And then you have, I don't know, the greatest quarterback prospect, just in terms of like cool to watch. Like, Andrew Luck was really good, but he wasn't always that fun to watch. Like, since Favre. So I say the chance is at zero, like legitimately zero that he retires. I know you think the Colts' best chance to grab a quarterback is in the free agent market. How crazy is it that we think we could or should trade for Carr or Stafford? And if we did get one of these quarterbacks, Brady Rivers, do you think it would be smart to still draft a quarterback like Fromm or Hurts? Well, I wouldn't draft Hurts. If you could trade for Stafford, I would 100% do that. If I was the Colts and I could trade for Matt Stafford, I would do that. If I could trade for Carr, Carr's probably better than Jacoby. But he makes a lot of money, so you'd have Carr. Same with Stafford. That's a lot of money to be paying two quarterbacks. It's kind of a tough situation. It really is. I don't know if there's a good answer. It's just, you know, to be honest with you, it's kind of the shitty part in being in the quarterback purgatory mode. You're just always like, what should we do? Should we sign a free agent quarterback? Tom Brady? Well, like, Tom Brady sounds great in theory, and he's still a good player. But he is 43-year-old Tom Brady. You're not getting, like, 33-year-old in his prime Tom Brady. Well, how about Philip Rivers? You mean the guy that was 38 and kind of looked washed last year? You know, the best option would be Drew Brees, and I've had some people DMing me, why wouldn't Drew Brees just go to the Colts? Be like, well, why wouldn't he just stay with the Saints if they want him back? That team's better. And he already knows the coach, and they're already on the same page. Like, what would be the difference? Now, you could argue the NFC, the road might be harder. Like, let's just look next year. Who's going to be good in the AFC? The Chiefs, more than likely, are going to be defending champs. They're going to be sweet. The Titans, but look at the Titans. Like, they got a couple question marks. Tannehill and Derrick Henry are free agents. Now, you can franchise and transition tag both. The Texans are still going to be around. Patriots will be back. Colts will be sneaky. You know, there's not the Ravens, obviously, will be good. The AFC kind of sucks. Look at the NFC. I mean, the Chiefs are really good, but look at the NFC. You got to have the 49ers are going to be really good again. The Rams are solid. Seattle. The Packers are all coming back. You know, if the Bears somehow can get a quarterback, they'll be decent. Who am I missing? The Vikings will be a 10, 11, you know, 9, somewhere in there, win team. The Eagles will improve. They'll be better. The Cowboys could be dramatically better with Mike McCarthy. You know, so it's just the Falcons, in theory, shouldn't start so freaking slow. The Redskins could be more competitive. They got a real coach. So it's just, I think the NFC's stacked. It really, hell, the Cardinals, who are one of the worst teams in the NFC, are like sneaky, not bad. The Tampa Bay, what was Tampa Bay's record? Like 7-9? With Jameis threw 32 picks? Imagine if Jameis just throws 18 picks. It might be 10 wins. I'm a Giants fan. Should I be worried about the Joe Judge after he hired Patrick Graham? When I saw like Rap Sheet or Schefter or whoever tweeted that Patrick Graham's their new defensive coordinator, my response was who? I know a decent amount of coaches, but there's now a new kind of cycle of guys in their mid to early 30s that I've never heard of. Because these guys are, and like you, I'm no different than you guys in the sense of, if you're some 31-year-old coach who's been a position coach for 1 year, I'm not going to really know who you are, especially if you're not coming from a big-time college program. These guys are shooting fast up the ranks so quickly. What's his name? Sean McVay just got rid of Wade Phillips for a guy that's been in the NFL for 3 years as a position coach for Fangio. Now, if I'm getting Vic Fangio Jr., I'm feeling pretty good. But this guy's been in the NFL for 3 years, and that's who you're replacing, Wade Phillips. Like, that's a pretty bold move there, Cotton. What do you think of the Packers need to do to beat the Niners? I think they need to get the Niners to turn the ball over. They're going to need to probably force multiple interceptions with Jimmy and probably create a fumble. So I would say the turnover, they got to win at like 2 or 3-0. You know, and if they turn the ball over once, that number, there still has to be 2-3 buffer. So I think the only chance the Packers have to win the game is to turn them over. And the Niners, you know, if they don't let Jimmy loose because they're running the ball, he's throwing a lot of high percentage completions. You know, so it's just, you know, he threw a pick, but he can get rattled when he faces really good defensive coordinators and you throw off his, you know, you throw off the coverages. I mean, he just didn't see Eric Kendricks, who's just a really good player. I think he thought he'd get it over him. It was a good play by Kendricks. But, like, is Blake Martinez going to make that play? Now, your DBs can pick the ball off. You know, the Niners are pretty well-equipped to just neutralize the front. It's hard. I mean, the Packers just aren't as good as the Niners. Now, Rodgers is a stud, but you know, he's got one sweet wide receiver, so he's at somewhat of a disadvantage. Appreciate everyone listening. Enjoy the week, and I'll talk to you a little later. Peace.